Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Oh my God, don't you know I'm a Cajun?
It's about Chris in your area.
In the area. Yes, you guessed it. We're going to talk about K-pop today.
And K-pop's been such a large part of our lives.
And it really does feel like for the last 15 years, it started to become more and more a part of the Cajun club life. And it's a huge part of it now. Donja, when did you first discover K-pop, actually?
I first had a bunch of crushes on J-pop stars, the precursors, in the late 90s. It wasn't something I knew much about because it was pre-internet. And I had to flip through CDs at Tower Records. And then when I started doing drag, you know, with an all-Asian drag troupe, I got a K-pop 101 course because we had to freaking perform them. And I had to learn Nobody by 21. And the choreography got me hating K-pop so hard. What about you?
Girl, 21 did not sing Nobody.
Look. How did I already get that wrong?
It's the Wonder Girls.
Wonder Girls!
Let me test your knowledge further.
Oh, God.
Name all four Blackpink members.
Oh, shit. Isn't it like fucking like Mincy, Cloud, Red, and Blue? I can't pronounce anybody's names.
Like, you're like not even close.
You're not I thought there were five people.
There's four girls. Oh my God. Well, obviously, we don't know what we're talking about at all. So I think if we're going to talk about K-pop and not get canceled, we should bring in other people who do know their shit. So let's just get started. Let's roll the intro music.
Literally Gaysians.
The podcast where two Asian guys who know very little about K-pop get real about their feelings and literally Gaysian stuff. Annyeong, I'm Chris, and this is my co-host and fellow canceled K-pop star, Bao.
Sanghaeyo, bitches. We're going to talk about K-pop.
I was a little nervous to talk about K-pop because, well, as we all know, already, I don't know anything about it. I can hardly pronounce the names of the groups, let alone know all the names of the singers. Many years ago, I got looks when I first said 2NE1 because I didn't know you were supposed to say 21.
You don't even know what song 21 sang. You thought they sang Nobody.
Clearly, I don't. Clearly.
And I mean, I'm not that much better. I mean, I used to walk around like really snooty about it and say like, I just don't get K-pop. And one of my friends actually made a playlist to convince me to like it. And it actually kind of worked. That friend is actually one of our guests on the episode this week.
So we invited him and two other K-pop fans to talk about K-pop's place in queer Asian life. That's us. And our personal favorites and unpopular opinions on K-pop.
Yes, light up the stands, girls. Let's just get into it and meet our guests.
Okay, I'm so excited and scared of having our K-pop stan friends on here to judge me because already when I fucked up earlier, I saw them all just rolling their eyes at me. It was so bad. But hello, friends.
Hi, friends.
Hi.
Do better, don't you?
I felt hate crimed earlier, just to be clear.
Okay, so let's get to it. Introduce your name and your favorite K-pop act and most obsessive thing you've done as a K-pop stan.
Hi, I'm Steve. My favorite K-pop group is a little group called Dreamcatcher. And it's not a thing I did as a stan, but I would say like the bizarre situation I found myself in when it came to anything K-pop related was right out of college, my first job was working for a Korean company that put on K-pop concerts in the U.S. And this is just as groups like Girls' Generation and Wonder Girls were taking off, and we had managed to book one of them, or so I thought, until like debt collectors started showing up at the office and all my paychecks bounced, and I realized, oh shit, this is a scam.
Oh, no.
Oh my God.
That's my K-pop story. That's why I love it. Can't get enough. Scam me more.
Oh, you're not a K-pop stan. You got K-pop scammed.
Oh.
Darren, how about you?
Hi, my name is Darren. And my favorite K-pop act of all time would be Girls' Generation. They were the one who got me sucked into K-pop in 2009 with their hit song G. I think only K-pop then who were from second generation will understand why it was so popular back in the day. Before them, I was really into J-pop. I didn't know BoA was Korean, and she's like the queen of K-pop, right? She started, well, I don't want to get into that, but like she's a big deal in Korea, and I didn't know she was K-pop because I used to listen to anime music, and she was in one of my favorite anime called Inuyasha, and she sang the soundtrack to the ending of one of the seasons. And so I fell in love with her, and then suddenly 2009 came, my high school friend showed me Girls' Generation, and we were in college, and I wasn't into it because it's too cutesy, but the hook GGG was in my head 24/7 since that day. And that's how I got into K-pop. And the most obsessive thing I'd done as a K-pop stan was I memorized all their legal names. Like in Girls' Generation, there's Sunny, that's the stage name, but her legal name is Lee Seung-gyu. And then Tiffany, and her legal name is Stephanie Hwang. So I memorized all their stage names, their birthdays, favorite colors, and all that crap.
Their birthdays?
Yeah.
Wow.
I was like obsessed when I got hooked into them.
And one of them is made red and blue, right? Totally. Totally.
Totally. Totally.
a note about Darren's love of K-pop, like before the pandemic, I think I was at like an after hours.
Oh my God.
And I remember you, Darren, being in the corner to like the circuit music, hours house music, doing K-pop choreo. I was like, oh, he's dancing differently. I'm like, wait, I think he's doing K-pop.
This is
choreo.
A dark room. Man, this is not.
Yeah, I was doing to Twice and feel special at her after.
I love so that you weird. Remember exactly what Corey we were doing 2 years ago.
Oh my God.
Well, that's when the song was big. And we kind of look into your subconscious, which is all K-pop. Wait, one thing about Steve I forgot. Like, Steve was the friend who made the playlist for me. He made this playlist of just all different tastes of K-pop. And I just put it on shuffle when I worked out. I'm like, I actually found a couple of songs I like. Just that note about Steve. He's the one who made that playlist and got me into it.
I have exquisite taste.
And last but not least, I'd love to introduce my drag sister, Buka K.
Hello, distinguished panel of judges, literally Gaysians, and my fellow panelists. My name is Jack. And my favorite K-pop act, since we've already gone through years past, including Dreamcatcher, as well as Girls' Generation, which is both of them are amazing as well. I'm going to talk about the current generation, which is the fourth generation. My current favorite act from the fourth generation right now is XG, which I'm repping on my t-shirt right now. Love them so much.
Left, right.
The most obsessive thing that I've done as a K-pop stan was also kind of similar to Steve, but not being scammed. But I was using my work connections to negotiate my way into a one-on-one meet and greet with BoA when she performed at the main stage at SF Pride back in 2009. And I was there.
I remember that.
Yeah. I talked with the then executive director of SF Pride. And I was also in charge of events marketing and media buying for a telecommunications company back in the day. And so So I was leveraging all I can to get in with her. And at that point, I was like, yeah, I'm going to bring in my family, my friends, everyone, come with me. And at that point, like the week before, they're like, hold up, you're not going to bring in the whole village. She's only going to meet with you and only for 5 minutes. But that was still a very memorable 5 minutes, and it's still a very much a core memory of mine.
You know, in the pre-internet days, it was Jack who introduced me to so much K-pop. I don't even know how you showed them to me. I don't know if they were DVDs, VHS, but you made me watch so many videos. And I like learned to appreciate. I didn't become a fan, but I learned to appreciate it.
It was at any party that I was at, I would take over the playlist, or like I have like a mixed CD. I would drop in and be like, this is going to turn into a K-pop party. And they're like, what the fuck is going on? So yeah, that's also another obsessive behavior of mine back in the day.
So now that we met everyone and learned how they got scammed or how obsessive they became about K-pop in the beginning, I want to ask you guys, just because you've heard from me and Chris already on this, like how did K-pop actually come into your lives? Darren's already talked about Girls' Generation, but from Girls' Generation, how did it blossom to like where you are with K-pop today?
So you know how K-pop is divided into the big three?
The big three what?
The big three entertainment. So I'm not ranking them one, two, and three. I just want to say the names: SM Entertainment, JYP, and YG. And I am a SM Entertainment stan because I fell in love with Girls' Generation first. And I see the evolution from how it went from just 2007, when Girls' Generation just came out, it was just a boy band, boys, male soloist world back then. They were like the only first one of the girl groups that try to conquer and overcome just being a girl group. They get so much hate because they were gaining attention. I don't know if you guys, like Steve or Jerry, remember the Dream of the Hallyu wave, where they were performing and they were only like 19, 18 at that time. And all these fans from different boy bands stood up and like faced their backs against them and just
what
rejected them while they were performing.
Misogyny is real.
It's really mind-blowing, and they still perform their hearts out like non-stop. And from then to now, I like how girl groups are almost treated as equally as boy bands, but not still the same. But it has evolved a lot from 2007 till now.
Would you say you favor girl groups over boy groups?
I definitely do favor groups over boy groups.
And Steve, how did K-pop come into your life before you got scammed?
Before I got scammed twice. I got scammed, but that's another story. Yeah, K-pop came into my life, I think back to as a kid. My mother would take me to the Korean market, and this is back in the 90s. And so they would have these like rows of televisions and VCRs just making copies of variety shows. And that's how we would take that piece of Korean pop culture back with us alongside, you know, tubs of kimchi. And we would sit around the TV and we would watch these variety shows. And on one of these variety shows is where I was introduced to this girl group called SES. And, you know, that's how I knew what Asian femme power looked like. You know, it was so cute, and it immediately resonated with me. And as it resonated with me, that's kind of like, it was one of those things where I realized like, oh, this is something that I, as a boy living in a mostly straight white world, like I can't share this with my straight white friends, you know? And so they were all into Nirvana, and I was into like secretly into SES and Celine Dion. And so like, you know, I always looked for like the little moments where I could share my love of K-pop girlies whenever I could. And it was always weird because like growing up, whenever these moments came, I tried to fight the urge, right? To be like, oh my God, I love all this pink. I love all this glitter. But once I gave it would just come out like a flood, you know, just like Darren's would come in or Jack would commandeer the playlist. I kind of like, it would all come out all at once in this like uncontrollable deluge. And then before you know it, I'm just like, oh my God, they know I'm a total gay.
It's like you're coming out.
That's how K-pop kind of came into my life. Yeah, it's all kind of entwined, this like hyper femme sincerity trying to emerge in 90s grunge flannel land.
I'm just imagining all these like the strict Korean guys you see in Beef trying to listen to like Pearl Jam, and you're like, listen to this, and it's like sparkly, like funny how our dreams come true. It's one of my favorite K-pop songs still.
Yeah, it's a recurring nightmare that even like with our mutual friends, I still like freak out at the thought of them discovering like certain playlists of mine that I'm hoping are private.
It's your sexy time playlist, but it's all glittery K-pop.
No, it's my crying playlist. It's my crying in the closet playlist. It is my howling at the moon playlist.
So Jack, how about you? How did K-pop come into your life?
I think someone had already mentioned this earlier. K-pop came into my life actually through J-pop. Utada Hikaru, First Love, in 1999 in high school. You know, all the AZNs were just crazy for that song. Seriously, if you're around that era, you know what I mean.
I'm still crazy for that song.
Just kept following Utada, and then she released Distance, and Distance had a few songs that were produced by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. If those who don't know, they're the producers for Janet Jackson, and I was really vibing with this kind of like Asian take on R&B, and I was looking for more of that. And then I found myself, you know, gravitating towards other Japanese artists like Crystal K, who also is worth a listen. She is a half Korean, half Black artist that actually sings in Japanese and has dominated the charts back in the early 2000s as well. And through that, I found BoA, which I talked about during my intro. And BoA, I actually, even though she herself is a Korean artist that had made her way in the K-pop scene, I found her through the J-pop scene, through her album, Listen to My Heart. Love that record, still bump that to this day, to the point where I actually performed an English rendition that I rewrote myself at a high school assembly, which I hope no one finds a video of. I was in a fishnet skeleton sleeveless, and the performance included me. It was like a senior thesis for my dance class. I performed with my high school friend Elvira, and she was abusing me. And I created this whole entire musical number where I was just like, well, I need you to listen to my heart.
Just for a little context, Jack and I went to the same high school, not the same time.
Oh, really?
But it was an academic high school, and that's not the kind of showiness that people typically offered to the rest of the class. So she was definitely one of the bigger personalities there.
Just from meeting you both, and you're both part of the Rice Rockettes, I would just figure it was a theater school. Because you guys are such big personalities. And you ended up in the same drag troupe.
I mean, my love for J-pop and K-pop, the way that it kind of came about, like, it, talking about taking over playlists, like, I also used to lead warm-up classes for my dance class because they let students do that. And I would put in a CD. You know, you would go to Kunikuniya at Japantown and you would save all the money to buy the import version of the J-pop or K-pop album, because, you know, that's when it's real. You know, like, that's when you know you're a fan. You're buying that $50 CD. And I would, like, plug it into, you know, the Iowa Sony sound system and be like, we're warming up to M-Flow. We're warming up to Crystal K. I know. BoA was really the start of my K-pop journey, because from there, I ended up finding out about Girls' Generation, and also a little known group at that point in 2003 as well. There's a K-pop R&B group called Big Mama, and their song was Breakaway. And that really kind of sealed it for me. That Breakaway song, the singing, seeing powerful Asian women, Korean women singing full vocal with power. I was like, I was hooked. Breakaway, oh man, oh, I can't wait. So BoA, Big Mama, and J-pop really was my entryway into K-pop.
When Jack was talking about like 2003, I was like, is she going to talk about Big Mama? Is she going to talk about Big Mama? And she brought up Big Mama. And the thing is, right before this, I was listening to like one, they did like a reunion thing on a web show called Killing Voice, where it's just live singing, and they still have it. And their harmonies are so tight. Like their harmony, like they are not, their level of vocal performance is beyond even what is quote unquote good for K-pop. It's like we're talking like En Vogue level here at this point. Like they're actual musicians, like, you know, like they're not just vocalists, they're singers, you know. And so also hilarious, like Breakaway, their music video is notable because the first half of the video, you see these four conventionally beautiful women singing. And the second half, the camera goes backstage to reveal Big Mama, who are women who do not fit the standard of beauty. Side note, so they're one of YG's earliest groups, right? And after YG would come 21, and after 21 would come Blackpink. And so YG, when YG had 21 out, their CEO would often call them ugly, you know? And so YG has a history of quote unquote, using like casting against Korean beauty standards at first until they finally got to Blackpink, in which case they just went for very conventionally beautiful ladies. And so that's an interesting little progression if you want to check it out.
That's wild that you say that, because I remember the exact moment that Jack introduced me to Big Mama, and I just screamed. I'm like, it's like Martha Wash. They had the front face and then the behind the scenes face, and it was amazing. It's weird. When I think back now to K-pop, I'm not necessarily a fan. I've been forced into K-pop because I know the likes of all of you. I'm not going to say that it's a negative thing, but I have definitely been forced into K-pop.
I mean, I've seen you forced into nobody. I've seen it.
Mm-hmm, yes. Mm-hmm. One of the Rice Rockettes' staple dance numbers is doing the Wonder Girls number, and not always well, but we've done it like about 50 times.
Y'all are still doing it in 2023.
If anything, I think we're part of the JYP. I think we're part of JYP's staple of talent now.
Oh my God.
It's a classic. It's a classic. Okay, so fast forward to today. K-pop is even huger, especially in queer Asian culture. How have you seen it grow specifically in the Gaysian scene?
I think when I first started coming out to West Hollywood in LA, 2011, I was 21 then. Because, you know, like, I just also kind of came out. I was Googling gay Asian nights in LA, and then Rage came up.
Ooh, she brought up the Rage.
So I went there, and surprisingly, they did play K-pop there. I was very, like, surprised because I didn't know America would actually play Korean music. And then over the years, they would add more and more Korean music into the playlist before Rage closed down. And then now there's
Switch.
That happens once a month in LA, and they play so much K-pop.
There's a whole like K-pop floor.
The second floor.
Yeah, the second floor, the K-pop floor.
I was there the whole night, but then all my friends were just like, no, I want to go.
I know. I'm like having a fun time. Then I look behind, I'm like, oh, my friends are ready to go back downstairs.
Yeah. Either downstairs or back to chapel.
Yeah, well, Rage Game Boy, I remember they always saved Brown Eyed Girls, Abracadabra until the end.
Oh, yes.
And when you hear that, like, the first, like, few notes, so, like, the synth, and everyone just, like, yes, goes crazy. I don't remember other K-pop that they played, probably because I was just wasted. But I do remember, like, I mean, I feel like the three songs I always remember from Rage is Brown Eyed Girls, Abracadabra, Kelly Clarkson, Since You've Been Gone. That was, like, the last call song. And then Fetty LeGrand. No. What is a Satisfaction person?
Fetty Benassi.
People do not like cancel me, but I feel like those are the three songs I kind of always remember. Like, they always put it in rotation.
Speaking about Game Boy, there was a lot of sense memory, because in a side conversation that Steve and I had in the DMs in preparation for this podcast, we were talking about BoA being at Game Boy in late 2008.
She was
promoting
her album as well as premiering a new music video at Rage at Game Boy. And for those of you who don't know what Game Boy is or was, Game Boy is an and was a queer, gay, Asian and Pacific Islander party that happened in West Hollywood at a club called The Rage. And I remember also in college, I remember all of us, like, especially I used to dance in at Berkeley with like True Element and stuff like that. And we would take trips down to LA because we knew that was where they were going to play K-pop music. And I remember it being such a fond memory of like, this is where we're going to find our community. This is where, if we see someone doing a dance, we know they pass the vibe check. As much as we were talking about in the earlier at the circuit party where Darren is in the back doing like a K-pop dance move to like a random music, like, I would be the person going like, even though the song is not playing, you're doing this dance move? Oh my God, yes, we're going to vibe. We're going to party. And that scene at Game Boy when they were the first club, especially a gay club, to really champion K-pop music as part of the queer community, and seeing a bunch of people kind of like knowing the moves and being together, that was a really big sense of community for me. I remember experiencing that such like, you know, there's so much, you know, about joy when you experience things, especially as marginalized groups. There's terms of, you know, black magic and stuff like that. But as an Asian myself, going to Rage and seeing K-pop being played and a community of people dancing to the same music, knowing the dance move, that was pure Asian and Pacific Islander magic for me. And I remember also, I was like, oh, it means a lot where my idol, like BoA, would come to a space like Rage and Game Boy to actually talk to the queer community to premiere a music video. I wasn't even living in LA. I knew she was going to be there. And so I remember going to there, and Steve and I talked about that as well. And I'm like, I kind of blacked out. but that was a really core memory for me as well. Kind of seeing a big K-pop, J-pop idol for me being in a queer space and making it a point to sort of like talk to the community and know the fact that we also are big fans of her was really, really heartwarming for me, and is still very much a core like memory for me.
You know, what I also found wild was BoA being at Rage and at San Francisco Pride is that she brought so many straight Asian folks into these spaces. And I thought that was a huge deal and very exciting.
It was so bizarre because I was there too. And like, remember, I remember like Solange finishing up her set, and I look over and I see like this like group of like young Koreans who look very straight come up. And I was just thinking, because it was on a Sunday, like, did church just let out? Is service done? Is that why they're here? Do they know someone I know? Do I need to run? Do I need to stay? Do I blend in? I don't know. So I remember that being a weird moment. I remember BoA, you know, she did her thing. She's obviously a great performer, but the banter was very awkward. She was like, I'll eat you up.
But was that the song then? It was her English, quote unquote, English album, right?
Yeah.
She was like, hello, San Fran. And then I'll eat you up. Do-do-do-do.
Oh, I do remember also telling my friends that I really want to go see BOA because the abbreviation is capital B, lowercase o, capital A, and people are like, wait, you're going to Bank of America? Like, I was like, no.
Her name is a backronym, meaning it was BoA is her actual name, but they turned it backwards into various acronyms to suit whatever she's supposed to be representing at the moment. At one point, it also meant Beat of Angels. And I was like, okay.
Can we talk about an abbreviation fail in the K-pop scene that is actually very queer to me? BTS. Their initial abbreviation was Boys to Search for Top.
I didn't know that.
Oh my God. And then they became Beast. They became Beast. But their initial appreciation.
Oh my God.
Whoa, I didn't
that's
know
very
that
about unfortunate. BTS.
That's gonna be my new Grindr profile name. Steve, what have you seen K-pop grow in the Gaijin scene?
I mean, I think like both Darren and Jack and you've all touched on it, just seeing how much of it gets played in places of gay congregation. And I think one thing I think that a lot of gay male communities can kind of like relate to is kind of like the diva worship that tends to happen, I think, in gay male cult communities. And now we have more visible signs of, you know, Asian divas that we can throw our dollars, shirts, and energy towards, you know. Back then, you know, Bo was a major focal point, you know, Utada were major focal points. And now we have more. You know, and because K-pop is such a visual medium, and that because it's so choreographic, and that the fandom kind of normalizes doing these dances in public, you just see a lot of like gay queer Asians idolizing literally Korean or Asian femininity in a very public way. And I guess masculinity too, but whatever. So it's just you just see a lot more of it, and you see a lot more people participate in a very public and visible way.
Where I first realized that, well, K-pop's a thing was when I was in Asia in 2018 and I was in Bangkok, and there's this one club where I forgot the name of the club.
Oh my God.
It's in Siloam 2.
DJ Station.
Yeah, yeah. And I was with a friend and they played Mamamoo Hip. And I'm like, wait, K-pop sounds like this now? Because I just thought it was like bubbly and just like too cutesy, like as Darren said. I'm like, K-pop sounds like this now? Like, it's jazzy, it's very interesting, but the musicality is crazy. But then there's like a stage of just gay guys who knew the choreo, and if you knew it, you just go up there. And I just got a hint there. I'm like, wow, K-pop is like actually big. Like, you know, like sometimes you need to feel like the energy around the music to kind of get it. And it started clicking a little bit. Actually, Steve, when we were at Seoul, we were in Seoul together, and we went to this club King. And then like that stage was really filled with like, if you knew the choreo to the song, go up and do it. And I was like, oh, this is so, like, and it was all the girl band music.
Yeah, and they were always offbeat.
They were shady.
Whoa. No, but there was always like the main guy, like maybe the guy gets paid or something, but there's like one guy who's really good. And I just love that. It was like, oh, it's a way for these queer Asian men to like perform or express their queerness. And I feel like that's something that, like, I don't know if people talk about enough, because in a preparation for this, I was trying to figure out like, is there a Asian K-pop researcher? And I did find some research, but it's all around the boy bands. Like, the queerness is around how like gender norms are performed or broken and shattered with the boy bands. No mention of the girl bands. And I feel like, particularly in our kind of gay male cis world, the diva worship is probably like the closer thing that I feel like the vibe to, like, at least what I see in my community around K-pop.
If I may add, interestingly enough, there is actually an obsession with girl crush amongst girl groups in K-pop, but it's very much insular within people who know about the fandom. I would love to call out, you know, Amber from FX. She herself presented in the group as a very tomboy aspect of the group, and she has still plays into that as a solo artist now. Even you were talking about Mamamoo, there's Moobyeon from that group is also like very much like lesbianized as well by the fandom as well, to the point even we were talking about Blackpink as well. I just recently saw a meme about like, oh, this member has this boyfriend, this member has this boyfriend, and Rosé is affiliated with a queer rainbow flag. There is a lot of talks within the fandom of Rosé being a lesbian. And so unless you really tap into that sort of fandom, I'm not saying any of this is true, this is all alleged, I don't want to be canceled, but there is a lot of talks amongst the girl groups within the fandoms about who is a lesbian, all of that stuff. And it is very interesting, the sort of like gender roles and the subversing of gender roles when it comes to kind of like female groups and who presents as a female versus the commoditization of girl crush and lesbianic sort of queer baiting. you know, that's probably a whole entire different episode. But yeah, the whole between girl groups and boy groups, like the queer baiting and sort of gender role and the ways that it kind of comes into play in the commodification of them as a consumable good is very interesting.
Yeah, my entire the section that I prepared for Be Real is about kind of that. I think it's so interesting when, especially with like Moonbyul or with Amber, I feel like, you know, present how they want to present. But with Rosé, that's such an interesting case that's emerged, because there was a very specific incident where it kind of went viral, where a fan walked up to Rosé and asked her, like, hey, do you support queer rights? And like, Rosé can't respond because that's a political statement. And we don't know where she stands on things. She, you know, lives in Korea, which tends to be a lot more conservative. So she just kind of does this, you know, and she makes a rock and roll sign. And that's still ambiguous, right? So I'm like, I'll talk more about it later. But like, I think it's so interesting how different fandoms from different parts of the globe kind of imprint onto individuals, and why do they imprint on these specific individuals? You know, that's always an interesting one.
Maybe for Amber was the most interesting case, because she was the only one that looks the most tomboy, and I think she opened up about how that she goes to like a girl's bathroom, and then some girls would be like, why are you here? Shouldn't you like be in the men's toilet instead of the girl's toilet? And she just like was very shook about it. But she really left the company, and she's, you know, she's still doing her. And I think she did open about it in an article, but this was a long time ago after she left SM Entertainment. So,
and if you didn't catch that, don't you? Rosé is actually one of the members of Blackpink, not Min.
You know, Rosé is the color red, so you just gotta give me that. Give me that.
And the color rouge. Azure. Oh my God, I love Azure.
So, like, I think for anyone who's more interested in, I think, entertainers in the K-pop idol world who present, who kind of play with gender in a very explicit or clear way, there's also Jowon from 2AM, who does a lot of drag performances. I think, and this is before K-pop became particularly big, there was, you know, an out trans woman performer by the name of Harisu, who you know, started off as a model and then became a singer, and experienced a, you know, pretty decent amount of success as an entertainer.
Yeah.
So these are also performers that you might want to check out. Links in the show notes below. Is that what you guys say?
Yeah.
Yeah, if I may, even BoA actually did a duet with a Chinese artist, her song Better, that was released in Korea, and then did a duet version in Mandarin with a who I believe to be born as female but a very tomboy artist. So so yeah, there's a lot of interplay of gender when it comes to sort of like K-pop and its relationship to commodifying it for international markets, which I know, Steve, you alluded to. We'll talk about it hopefully later. But it's actually really interesting because, yeah, there's a lot of it at play. But I think a lot of the people that know K-pop at the surface, or even just is just a casual fan of K-pop, see a lot of queerbaiting coming out of male bands, which is very much true. But for people who are very much deep in it, which we are, there is a lot of queer coding in a lot of the girl bands of years past, as well as in now, which, you know, this would be a totally different episode if we go into it. But it's very interesting, especially, I don't want to age myself, in the decades of fandom that I've participating in K-pop. It's very interesting to see the queerness and how it's expressed across both girl groups and boy groups as well.
At the same time, it's also an American perspective of it. Like, sometimes you hear about like, oh, you know, that boy group, they all look so gay, but it's considered gay in Korean culture. That's more of an American lens.
What is considered, you know, acceptable homosocial behavior, it differs from you know, culture to culture, so when you look at behavior that in Korea would be like platonic and homosocial, but from a Western lens would be viewed as homosexual, and then the fandom kind of runs with it, then that's, there's a, I think there's a lot of like, that makes me uncomfortable at times.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
All right, now we're going to hit you with the debate, and we're going to keep it friendly. Dolce and I are going to lob some questions about your taste in K-pop, and we're going to debate it.
Oh,
are you
God.
Guys ready?
I wasn't ready.
I'm still
reeling from the pun. Such masterful wordplay.
Debate. Okay. That's not 21, don't you? That's Blackpink. But first topic, what is the most underrated K-pop song or act? And I'm going to start with you first, Jack.
My most underrated K-pop act is After School. They really came up and had a really big song with Because of You. Love that song. But the tenacity and the concepts that they came out with, even after Because of You, like, let's talk about it. Bang did a drum line. They performed at live performances in a drum line. Shampoo, they did tap dancing, learned tap dancing, did it in live performances. First Love, athletic pole dancing. And then even the leader, Kahi, who actually used to be a backup dancer for BoA for 3 years before she actually got into a K-pop group, which is S-Blush, a Korean-American group that was disbanded. And then she got into After School. The amount of dedication and the things that they did with every comeback was freaking amazing. And they never charted... after like Because of You, they charted enough, but I don't think they got the level of respect that they should have received for the amount of artistry, tenacity, and practice and everything that they did in every comeback. After School, all day, every day, most underrated K-pop act.
I agree.
Do you agree that they're the most underrated?
Was that your choice too, Darren?
It wasn't my choice, but they are one of the most underrated because of the concept that they keep switching members every comeback. And so
wait, fans, what?
Yeah, they keep bringing in new members every year or so. And so
it's like Menudo. They just change members all the time. And they've been going on for like 30 years.
Or Destiny's Child.
But it wasn't an excuse. Like, they didn't use the fact that they were changing members, because the concept of After School was they were always like, there's going to be members who would graduate like school.
Right.
We would graduate every like members. And with every new concept, it wasn't used as an excuse. Oh, this new member didn't do shit. They came in with fire every comeback, even with a new lineup. And it's not like a total new lineup. There's one or two members that would be added in, and it was freaking fire every time they came back. Anyways.
Right. My bad. Because I read an article that Kai was telling the agency that they should stop adding members every comeback because it does confuse the fans, not because they weren't doing their best. But she did tell the CEO that you need to stop doing this because it's not good for the fan.
Darren, sup in the goss.
Yeah, what about you, Darren?
Yeah, what's your most underrated K-pop song or act?
I think my most underrated K-pop act would be, on the global scale, would be Red Velvet, because, you know, they are labeled as the big three. They are from SM Entertainment, which is one of the big threes that South Koreans usually refer to. And they're not getting the same amount of love as Twice from JYP and Blackpink from YG. I think because like they have all these different concepts, right? Their Red side, which is more of their more playful, childish side albums. Their Velvet side, which is more their mature side. And then they have the Red Velvet side, which is like both combined. And sometimes people would not understand the Red Velvet side. Like, if someone Google a YouTube Zim Zala Beam, they're like, WTF, I don't understand what this music video is about. But if you see, like, Blackpink is girl crush, only girl crush music, EDM, hard-hitting songs. Twice is, like, mostly cutesy for, like, 90% of their careers. And then recently, they released more mature and charismatic songs. Whereas Red Velvet released all three concepts in 1 year, which I don't get bored of. But I think maybe people like to maybe stay within one range. I don't know. But I think they're very underrated because they can do all three concepts really well.
For Red Velvet, that was one of my gateway songs to K-pop. It was in the playlist that Steve made, Bad Boy. And I like, so is that the more mature side?
Yeah.
Is that the mature side?
The Velvet side.
Are we supposed to debate? Because I got thoughts on both of y'all's. Or I could just move on to mine. Or we could continue with Darren.
Let's hear your thoughts, Steve.
You want to hear my thoughts? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now that it's a debate. You know, I think my fellow panelists bring up a couple of interesting points. And you know what? Let's point out the things about them that are valid. You know, I do think After School from like an international standpoint probably isn't recognized for, you know, the amount of work that Kahi, their original leader, had to put in, because not only was she their lead performer, she was also their trainer in a lot of ways, right? And yeah, they definitely did a lot of really interesting things. Yeah, but at the same time, I feel like now they got their druthers. They got their druthers while they were active, you know? Yeah. And then with Red Velvet, I see Darren's point that, you know, they're not as popular as their contemporaries. But I guess what I'm struggling to understand is how they're underrated, because I think they're actually fairly well recognized by the broader fandom. And, you know, like, you know, they're very talented. I think there's not a lot of dispute about that. Now, whether or not their success is like commensurate or like proportionate to their talent is a different story, because one of my hot takes is that I think a lot of the K-pop fandom does not care about talent that much. You know, it's a lot about the production, which is, you know, if that's what you like, that's what you like. The real answer to this question is Dreamcatcher. Dreamcatcher is the most underrated group. And let me tell you why Dreamcatcher is underrated.
They're not that popular.
I do love them too.
Dreamcatcher is underrated because literally, despite their talent and their perseverance, you know, they are now gaining some recognition, but they're virtually unknown in Korea itself. And while they have a fervent they now have a fervent following, they're very much niche. In addition to the fact that they just are literally, you know, underrated because they just aren't having success commensurate with their effort, I think they accomplished a few things that are super rare in K-pop. One thing that's super rare in K-pop is a group that actually has a sound, okay? A lot of groups jump between different sounds. You know, you don't really identify a group unless you know their voices, which is kind of rare because most timbres kind of fall into a K-pop melange, or because you follow them. Dreamcatcher has a sound from their initial revamp when they came together as Dreamcatcher. They decided that, hey, we have a sound. It's going to be every anime opening wet dream. It is J-rock. It is prog rock. It is pop punk. It is EDM, but they always keep that electric guitar. The girls commit to a subgenre that is not popular in Korea. And on top of that, I think you are now seeing The fruits of their labor emerge in other parts of K-pop. Recently, there's a popular group called G-Idle or IDE that Idol. Has kind of like capitalized on their pop punk sound that was popularized first by Dreamcatcher. And this is why Dreamcatcher is the most underrated. Thank you. I'm now open for cross-examination, although I will be correct.
I know you're not taking ready? I know you're not taking any questions. But may I ask, did you like G Idol coming after Queendom or before that?
I don't really like G Idol that much.
What?
I'm neutral on them. I'm neutral on them.
You brought up G Idol. I just wanted to ask because I remember they were a part of the contestants during Queendom. Is it season one?
My favorite Queendom contestants were Lovelies. And they got trapped.
Okay,
they were so bad.
Get your opinions, and I'll mute myself.
They did not do well on the show.
I think they tried to be sexy, but that's not their forte.
Well, Dreamcatcher, I remember once, Steve, we were drunk and you were just showing me a bunch of different, you were doing the auxiliary cord thing, just showing me a bunch of different K-pop videos, like, because this is during the playlist era, you made the playlist. Is Dreamcatcher sort of like the Evanescence-y sort of K-pop
group? Yeah.
Okay. Because I remember those, like, this is like the Evanescence of K-pop. And you're like,
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, sure.
I just want to make sure I heard that correctly. Did you just say the Evanescence of K-pop?
Yes. I think they are. Can be.
I don't have enough alcohol for this.
I do want to point out that that K-rock and like obviously like Korean music expands beyond K-pop, right? And with K-pop it's mostly like idol performers. But yes, in the poppy world of K-pop, they're the Paramore. I think they're more akin to Paramore than they are to Evanescence.
For me as the stupid one, what is an idol performer?
So, okay, so...
Oh my God, everyone's rolling their eyes at me.
So I think an idol... I actually have notes on this. An idol is like an entertainer who is usually very young, usually a teen or a young adult, and is usually kind of like goes through a training, and it is... works under the auspices and directions of a larger agency, you know, and they're more about the entertainment, about the craftsmanship, and maybe less concerned with the actual artistry of creating music, not to diminish their accomplishments or their efforts. But, you know, they're you know, young people who sing and dance and kind of like fit into the mold of a teen idol. Take on it. They're an entertainer, yes.
Yeah, okay. All right, that explains a lot for me. So, here we go. Welcome!
Here it goes.
Here it goes.
Who is your most overrated K-pop song or act? Let's, you know what? Let's just continue with you, Steve.
No, I was going to wait to see how hard they went. I was going to match a mirror because if we're going to get canceled, we have to get canceled together.
We need you to be canceled. Steve, who is your most overrated K-pop summer act?
Every single boy band. That is my answer. Every single boy band is overrated.
I'm with you on that.
Because they benefit from the patriarchy. No. They don't have to work as hard as the ladies. Single boy band. Nah, but they get more. They get more for less.
I'm not trying to cancel you, Steve, but does BTS fall underneath your definition of overrated boy bands?
Oh, it definitely does. They definitely do.
I am not going to point to any single actor or group because I want to be able to walk down the street without being, you know, like assaulted. But I will say men in general are an overrated act, you know? By overrated, I mean like, I feel like their success, you know, it's a little skewed higher than I think it should be as a whole. And I think
I extremely agree with Steve by asking whether or not it is generational. Were you more into boy bands during Gen 1, Gen 2, or even Gen 3?
I was never into boy bands. Okay. I was into boy bands. Purist.
Interesting.
Here.
Yeah, Steve doesn't enjoy male vocals.
Got it.
This is largely true. There's like one male vocalist that I like, and that's about it.
Who is it?
At least in K-pop. His name is Hwani. He's part of a little duo called Fly to the Sky. He's got like this booming, smoky baritone. He also has like a really extensive upper range. So it's just like, that's what I want. Not, yeah, but everyone, yeah. That's my case.
Okay. I'm with you on that. I shared a Spotify playlist with a friend, and it was an R&B playlist, and it was open to add, and I got so upset at him when he started putting male R&B vocals in there. This was clearly an all-female vocals R&B playlist.
Yes.
And I don't listen to it anymore. It's terrible.
Next person.
Who wants to go next? Who feels strongly?
Well, I can go next. I wouldn't say a K-pop act, but K-pop song that I feel very overrated.
I'm so excited.
BTS Dynamite. It's literally everywhere for the longest time ever. And I think they had better songs. Like before Dynamite, they had really good songs. And after Dynamite, kind of like...
I love that song.
Yeah. No, I can't. I really love Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Butter was good, but I just couldn't get into Dynamite. But I do agree with Steve that I think boy bands have it easier than girl bands, for sure. Mm. Girl bands need to do more than boy bands, 100%.
So I know you represent... like different music artists, is it harder to represent male versus female artists?
I think it's harder to represent female artists because, like, it's just like if they're wearing the wrong outfit, they may seem promiscuous. But if the boys are wearing the same level, it's okay. You know, even America is like that too.
Misogyny.
So it's just like misogyny at the finest, and it's kind of annoying when I witness it in person too. I'm just like, I was like, this is what the stylist wants them to wear.
Jack, who's your most overrated? Let's see where this goes.
This has nothing to do with the acts or songs that come out of this agency. But I feel the most overrated agency is YG. I'm saying that.
I agree.
They have fucked over every artist. Yeah, they have fucked over every artist. Just because 21 didn't hit a number one, they told them that they were going to be like disbanded. Like Big Mama was also disbanded. Now I'm glad that they are part of it. And then look at the mess that's happening with the... is Lisa going to sign or not? Like, why is that even news? Like, I'm glad they do a lot of talent production. And yes, but even with like, let's just talk about this. YG was about to, I guess, announce the fact that they're going to do contract negotiations with Blackpink. And Baby Monster was not even close to debuting. And they did a whole entire reality series about Baby Monster as their new group to cover their asses in case Blackpink doesn't resign. What is happening with Baby Monster right now? No single, no performances, all of that stuff.
Nothing.
There's a lot of fanfare for YG for no entire reason. And maybe an unpopular, you know, K-pop opinion is, I wish Lisa from Blackpink doesn't re-sign with Blackpink. Let me be clear. I'm a big Blink fan. I'm a big Blink. Let me just tell you this. But the amount of mishandling of talent with YG and their talent pool, I'm like, YG in and of itself as an entertainment sort of company and management sort of entity is totally overrated.
Ooh.
Any responses? Oh, everyone agrees.
I agree.
I think you bring up some interesting points.
I'm nodding. I mean, I feel like he should treat the artists better too. Like, it's just crazy how what's happening right now with Blackpink.
It sounds a lot like the the US like music industry from like decades ago, they call these shots and they're just shitty to so many people. I mean, still are.
All right, it's time to be real, the part of every episode where we talk about whatever's on our hearts or minds. And because this is the special K-pop episode, I'm going to ask a specific Be Real question just to our guests, which is, what is a complicated or tough feeling that you have about K-pop? And Jack, I think I'm going to start with you. Let's be real about K-pop.
Knowing my, I guess, love of K-pop and the amount of investment that I've had in K-pop, I've also understood the history of where K-pop sort of got born out of. And if we're talking about Generation One, which is the first generation of K-pop, which is more for those that you don't know, the first gen of K-pop is 1996 era, so like early 2000s. A lot of it was influenced by R&B culture and hip hop and stuff like that. There is still a level of appropriation of Black culture in K-pop that makes me feel very uncomfortable. As recent as, you know, as much as I'm wearing this shirt XG, Kokona, being in braids and not knowing stuff and stuff like that. And I still consume K-pop with the knowledge and the respect of knowing and respecting Black culture from where it was born from and where it's pulling from. And also as a fan, making sure that I'm not just blindly consuming Black culture from a Korean lens. And so I still need to check myself around the fandom. And like, to be true, Blackpink's still doing that. All of these boy bands are still doing that. Yeah. So I'm still very conflicted about it. But also K-pop is also very much a melting pot of all of these different musical influences and cultural influences, which is what make K-pop such an addictive and interesting sort of like experience from a fan perspective. And it's not even from Black culture now. They're like in, like, we were just talking about JYP, like, hey, we're going to start a K-pop band from, you know, recruiting members from the US. Like, let's recruit a blonde white member and like all of that stuff. Mm. And so a lot of the questions that I have in my mind right now is, who gets to perform K-pop? Who gets to say that I am doing K-pop? And I don't know. I don't have the answer for that, but that's something that's sticking out in my mind in regards to cultural appropriation and the history of where K-pop has resulted and where we understand it now as a melting pot of all these different cultures, and also holding them accountable that saying like, hey, these appropriation is not okay. So
I feel like that. The early days of K-pop, which is what made me dislike it, was that it all seemed so derivative. But like you said, it's all of those things. But I feel like in the modern times, they're creating culture now.
Yeah, no, I hear you on XG. Remember, I think like a couple weeks ago, they released a video and like, we were just chatting about it, Jack. I'm like, thank God she's not in braids. We're just like, oh, thank goodness.
Fucking cornrows on these men.
Yeah, and then we were at Coachella, the Coachella the second week, and I'm like, with Jennie's look, I'm like, those braids, I guess. But I was like, it took me like a good 15 or like 20 minutes to like be able to like, let's just get out of the appropriation thing and just like try to enjoy this. But still, it's something that just always keeps coming up.
But also just, I'll make this quick. Reading the comments in YouTube and stuff like that, there are fandom from Black culture and from Black Twitter and what have you that are saying that it's not an issue. So I also need to check myself. Am I policing a culture that's not mine? That other people who are coming from Black culture and from those who K-pop is appropriating from saying, I'm glad that we're getting a platform where our style and our culture is being received in a positive manner and they're not, you know, they're not doing blackface, you know, thankfully. Mm. But like, and so I'm also on the flip side of that. I'm also checking myself. I'm like, am I over policing? And so, you know, that's kind of like the burial factor of this conversation. I'm like, yes, I also come from a standpoint of making sure that marginalized people aren't being taken advantage of. But if I'm seeing from the fandom that they are okay with it, then maybe it's okay. But who am I can't make that judgment, right? So that's the push and pull of it.
Darrence, what is a complicated or tough feeling that you have on K-pop?
I think a really tough thing I have on K-pop is definitely mental health. Because it's a really big topic because two of this K-pop artists that were from this really big bands I follow, Jonghyun from SHINee and Sally from FX, they both committed suicide and they were only like 27, 25 at that time. They were really young. One thing from the article that shook me was that he was telling a news reporter that the doctor was blaming his personality to not shake this depression away. And in my head, I'm just like, I don't know how you can shake depression away without having a professional help guiding you. This idol started their career when they were like 13. And the amount of pressure and hate from how to do better being a performer from people who are not even performers, like millions of people who are not even performers, and you're reading comments, like, I can't understand, but they're feeling the pressure for like all these years. And I think Jonghyun from SHINee was saying, I've been feeling this pressure for 10 years. After Sally and Jonghyun committed suicide, the K-pop industry finally took an action to do better and take care of their artists' mental health, which I think is really important because during COVID, not someone I'm close with, but someone that I knew also committed suicide because he was depressed and couldn't convey his feelings about what he was going through. And I'm just really happy that the community is actually bringing awareness to this after not just Sully's and Jonghyun's death, because there is many more after that, but I'm just happy that they are providing the artists what they need to help get through whatever they're going through.
Yeah, it seems like really hard for these essentially child stars, just like in America too, to have these amplified feelings and to not live a, I guess, common life like others, and to be always in the spotlight with so much pressure. And it's shitty.
It's just a lot, especially if you're like Sally. She was 11 when she started working as a child actress, and from then she debuted in the girl group, and then I don't know how all this child actor and actresses deal with all that pressure.
Yeah, and this doesn't seem to be like anyone on their side advocating for them. So, Steve, you're the last one. What is a complicated, tough feeling that you have about K-pop?
Yeah, okay. So, this is a little messy. Normally, I'm an extremely articulate and well-spoken person, but, you know, I'm going to be a little bit looser with this. Some of these things that I'm about to point out might sound like conservative talking points, and other points might directly contradict things. I think there's a lot of things that I feel about this one particular topic.
It's a complicated feeling.
Yeah, huh. I will exfoliate these feelings off of me for you in real time. Okay. So the main thing is, I feel very uneasy about how casually and flippantly fans will kind of imprint or cast a sexuality onto a performer. So, and it's usually not done with malice, right? They're usually saying like, oh, she's so, like, this is so sapphic, and they mean it in a way that they enjoy it, right? The fans are progressive, support queer rights or queer themselves, and are looking for, you know, for themselves in these performers. And given what I was talking about, I don't think that's a bad thing. However, when it's done very publicly and en masse, I think people forget that, you know, this international progressive casting of someone as or quoting of someone as queer, that person, we don't know what the, how they identify. And they live in a society that is far more conservative. And so I don't think it always plays out, and maybe I think I'm like worrying too much about it, but it's the idea that like the international progressive community is making their favorite idols targets for homophobia locally, you know? And I think that's, I'm not saying that's necessarily what's happening, but whenever some like someone who isn't as attuned to Korean culture just kind of like says, oh, she's so gay, I love it, I always makes me wonder, like, is she? You know, like, maybe she is. And on the flip side, like, then I think, like, you know, whether someone is or isn't queer, I feel like it's not right for someone to kind of take away a chance to speak for themselves, you know, and to speak for them. Because, you know, declaring something about yourself, however you declare it, is a personal thing. You know, now I'm going to, on the flip side, I also understand that because Korea is a conservative society, you know, there might be queer artists who are trying to signal things, but can't necessarily say it outright. But then, like, there are ones who I think are doing it pretty clearly. And in those cases, I'm just like, whatever, people are going to say what they can say. But then there are cases where I'm like, actually, like, when someone is like holding hands or acting very affectionately to someone of the same sex, it might be completely platonic in, you know, their eyes, but interpreted otherwise through another cultural lens. And so there's no call for action here. But it's something I always kind of talk about with friends when they kind of like casually say it, where I'm just like, hey, maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, but I just think it's important to be aware of the fact that these performers, even though they're perceived internationally, they live locally, and where they live is very different. And I think it hits hard for me particularly, because I think about, like, there's a very particular strain of homophobia that I experienced growing up in like Korean American communities, where the last thing I wanted to do was do anything that could be perceived that way, or give me away or out me before I was ready. Maybe it's me projecting, but I'm always just kind of like wary when there's like a video on YouTube being like, so and so being gay for 5 minutes. I'm like, she's just eating, you know?
It's just general celebrity culture and all the things that we expect of people. It's shitty, yeah. But we all do it. We all do it.
I feel like it's also intentional from the artist marketing team. Like, they know that they're going to get that conversation, and it helps.
And sometimes it's baiting, which I think is also iffy. But, like, to your point, like, I think of, like, some of, like, the people, like, in American society, when we used to kind of, like, publicly say, oh, so-and-so is gay, but, you know, they weren't or whatnot. Like I feel like, oh, we shouldn't have taken that away from them. We shouldn't force someone to declare sexuality, you know? So that's my take.
All right. That's all the time that we have for today. So thank you so much for coming onto the podcast and also potentially getting doxxed by the K-pop stand. So thank you, Jack. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Darren.
Okay. So to send all of you off, we're going to ask you one final question. What's the perfect song to start exploring K-pop for any newbies?
I would pick I Swear by Sistar.
Okay. No, yes. Comments. Yeah. No comments.
Oh, you want to do this gone. Move? You want to do this move? You
know, I don't even know any of the moves. It's just a brilliant song.
Darren, what's your send-off?
I want to say especially for this generation, 50-50 Cupid.
Jack Bukake, what's your send-off?
My song would be Left Right Remix XG. By XG with Sierra. Yes, Sierra. One, that's two, so step good. Sierra. Plus Jackson Wang.
We saw that at Coachella.
It was Coachella!
It was so
I get
good.
Wet when I watch that video.
Wow.
where can everyone follow you on your socials if they want to find you and, you know, send hate mail to you?
They can't. I'm not on the socials.
If you can find me, and if I accept you, it's Instagram at KINGLCHOI, which is King L Choi. And it also has been a pleasure to talk to everyone here today. I can't believe that I had this amount of wealth of knowledge that I could geek out with. And
well, not for me.
No, but seriously, thank you so much for Literally Gaysians. Like, y'all have been doing amazing work, and it's been a pleasure to be on with y'all as well as with this group of panelists today. I'm so geeked out. I'm probably going to go out into the living room to talk to my husband about K-pop, and it's almost 11 o'clock.
And Darren, where can we find you?
I can find you on my TikTok, DLKL90, if you want to send any DMs. but also, my group of friends don't know anybody but Blackpink and NewJeans at the moment, so I'm glad I'm able to talk about other girl groups and since the second and first generation. So I'm really happy for this podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. And even though I'm in that group, I know the Seraphim. I just don't know the members.
We're not going to say their name. Stop talking about the group. It's not the only group.
Wait, Sakura.
One of them is Jennifer.
Jennifer. All right. Well, you can follow us at Literally Gaysians on TikTok and Instagram.
And you can join us in a few weeks for another episode. Till then, listen to your favorite K-pop song. Bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.